Get ready for a parenting adventure. Welcome to Little Adventures Parenting and Beyond, the podcast that explores all things family. From child development to mental health, we've got you covered. Join us for a fun and informative discussion with expert guests and real-life parents. Let's go on an adventure.
Welcome to another episode of Little Adventures Parenting and Beyond, where today we have a special guest, Jessica McClement, who's going to talk to us about being a former teacher of students with autism. So, welcome, Jessica. How are you today?
Good.
Can you tell us about your journey and what inspired you to specialize in serving students with autism during your teaching career?
Yeah, so I have an uncle that has autism, and, you know, back in, like, the 70s when he was born, they didn't really have, like, he was institutionalized when he was about 5 and lived in a state institution until he was about 30 and then put into a group home. So I think I just saw firsthand how inhumanely people with disabilities are treated. And I always just really loved like hands-on activities and working with kids. And I just wanted to help students with special needs to have more of a equal opportunity, I guess.
I like that.
That's beautiful. That's wonderful. You know, if you're not in it, you don't see it and you don't know. Because I will say, like, I never saw how differently people were treated until I started, you know, volunteering in the school and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think even now, like, you know, they try to mainstream most kids and there's like a lot of laws and stuff to help make them more accepted, but it's still like a lot of stereotypes and things like that.
I completely agree with that. I see that a lot in my own classroom. So
yep.
It's sad to see, but it seems to be getting better as the years progress, but we're still not where we need to be, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So what are some common misconceptions about autism that you've often encountered?
I think a lot of them are, you know, that they're not smart. People misconcept that where it's a spectrum disorder, so it's a wide range of IQs. They could be mentally retarded, or they could be on genius level or just normal intelligence. Also, that they all have behavioral issues, which is not true, or just like bad kids. I feel like a lot of people think like they don't understand they have a communication disorder, and that's why they have behaviors that are unusual to people. And sometimes they are violent and stuff, but it's just because they can't communicate the way they're supposed to. So people think they're just like, I guess, like crazy, but they're not.
Right. So how do you create that supportive and inclusive classroom environment for them to make sure that they feel heard and seen and that they have that same environment as the rest of the other students that may be labeled as typical?
So I use a lot of research-based techniques. I used to work, my first teaching job ever was in a school for kids that could not even, they were so severe, they could not even be in a school district in a self-contained classroom. So we did ABA and discrete trial. We had 2 ABA therapists on the premises. I was trained in all the ABA therapy technique.
For those of us who are not,
I'll explain what it is. It's applied behavioral analysis. So it's a technique used to teach kids with autism and to modify their behavior to be more typical. Sometimes when I went to a public school, some of the things I did seemed a little strange. Maybe not in New Jersey, but when I was in Florida, because some of the teachers there just have to pass a test. They don't have, like, that hands-on, like, teaching experience from college. So I would use things like weighted vest, weighted blankets, weighted lap belts for sensory input, boxes the kids could go into, feel more secure, the lights off a lot of times, soft music playing, covers for the fluorescent light, sensory activities built into the lessons, small group instruction so they're not overstimulated. I mean, usually there's no more than 10 kids in a class anyway. And, you know, I still held the same expectations for them because they are capable of doing what typical children can do. They just need it delivered a different way. Frequent breaks. Some kids had to go jump on a trampoline for a while or something, right, then come back and work, doing whatever was going to make them feel comfortable so they could be successful.
That's amazing. I know in TJ's old school, they had a student who felt really comfortable going underneath the desk to do work. And obviously they let him do that. But TJ was like, well, why does he get to go underneath the desk and why can't I? So I was like, well, he needs to go under a desk to concentrate and do his work. But it did. It was able to help him focus and get his work done, which was fantastic that the teacher used those skills.
Yeah, I think if more general education teachers were more accepting and just had more training, we could have more kids mainstreamed because they don't understand that they need those things sometimes. They would be able to just be fine in a regular classroom, and it would make the other students more accepting of them also.
I think that is a big thing because in our educational journey, I majored in elementary ed, and we had very limited special education type of teaching practices that we practiced while we were in college. You know, you wait until you get into it, and then you figure it out as you go, and you work with the EC teachers, or you work with speech and OT and PT that come into the school, but they can only train you so much while you're also in a general education classroom. So it would be nice if there was a better way to train gen ed teachers as well, I think.
Yeah, so I went to college in Pennsylvania. I was in a dual program. So you're like gen ed, elementary ed, and special ed together. So I think that was like really helpful. And then I have an associate's degree in human development, which is special ed and early childhood. You're going like, yeah, I think everyone should maybe have some more classes. And like I said, in Florida, you can just pass a test and teach and have no idea what you're doing. Like, I would train like half the teachers in my unit because they were just like paraprofessionals before. But I mean, you could work in a special ed classroom as a paraprofessional, but you don't know that research, and especially ASD. Like, I have my master's in special education, but I have a special certificate in ASD, and all this new research that came out since I was an undergrad and everything, you have to keep staying on top of it. And a lot of people have never been trained in discrete trial or ABA. And sometimes with the ABA, the applied behavioral analysis, some people think, oh, she's being mean. With kids with autism, they're so smart. Sometimes you have to be very stern because they learn. They throw those tantrums because they learn, if I do this, I get what I want. Sometimes people look like when I first went to the ABA school, like when I first graduated college, I used to get beat up because I'm pretty small, and they'll flip desks on you and stuff. But they kept telling me, they're like, you have to be firm. You have to be firm. Like, they're going to take over, like. So it takes a while to get used to it. Like, I used to cry sometimes when I left. And I have to, like, put a kid in a padded area or something. But that was for their safety and ours. And, I mean, things like that, they eventually learn. Like, I'm not going to get away with what I'm trying to get.
So with, obviously, you need collaboration between teachers, parents, other professionals. That's crucial for supporting those students. Can you discuss the importance of collaboration and share some examples of successful collaboration efforts that you were a part of?
Having parents that are on board with your techniques and what you're trying to do and wanting their children to be successful is really important. Some parents, either they, I've experienced a lot. Sometimes the child is not as severe as the parent wants them to be. And sometimes the parents just don't want to work with them at home. Like, I actually had a family in Florida, in Orlando. They had three kids on the spectrum, and it all was self-contained. And I end up teaching all three of them. But I had the middle child the longest, probably like 3 years. The youngest one, I had her in pre-K. I almost don't think she was even ASD. I pushed her up to gen ed when she went to kindergarten because I think she just learned a lot of behaviors from him. The parents never wanted to follow through with anything at home. So when we got to school, we worked so hard, and it was just so hard getting him in the building. And then at the end of the day, we couldn't get him out of the building because he wanted to, like, put on a show for the parents. So I think parents really need to be on board and work with the teacher, working with the gen ed teachers if you're mainstreaming a kid, or there would be kids that are mainstreamed in the classroom, but they were still on my caseload. Like, I wrote their IEP and everything. So I had to collaborate with those teachers, find out how they're doing in the class and stuff like that. But also with your physical therapist, the OT, speech therapist. I have one speech therapist I worked with for years. And I had different grade levels with her. Like, I taught in that ASD unit for a while, and I started out with second through fourth grade. Then I had first and kindergarten, and I had pre-K there too. So, but I always worked with the same speech therapist, but we developed our lessons together, like our literacy lessons. Like, we picked the same book. So it was like the kids were getting like a double dose of it, and we would work on the IEPs together to make sure we were like asking each other, do you think this child would work good with this goal? Do you think they mastered it? And stuff like that. Just to make sure everyone was on the same page. So collaboration is really important just to make sure the students are making progress.
I think that's so crucial, especially being a gen ed teacher, knowing that you have the same goals in mind when you're teaching, because that is hard when you have an IEP in front of you, but you didn't work on it together. Mm-hmm. And then you're teaching totally separate lessons, even though you have their IEP goals on there. It's very different to have that conversation beforehand and say, hey, this is what I'm doing in my piece of it, and then this is what we're doing here, and how does it kind of tie together to support them? Because it's also a hard transition when they're going from one place to another, and they might miss something in the gen ed classroom when they're in the special education classroom. I love that. What role did individualized education play in meeting the specific needs of students with autism during your teaching career?
So the IEP is the individualized education plan. So that is really important, because that is where you dissect what the child really needs to grow, what area they need to grow in to become successful in school. You know, you're taking little steps to make them successful over their whole, making sure they're going to be successful academically, social, emotional, physically. For some kids in general education, they're not always working on behavior skills and social skills, but we work on those in little bits so that they can eventually focus on the academic skills. But also, there's academic skills in the IEP, but it's smaller. Like, a lot of the kids can't write their name yet. A lot of them have fine motor and gross motor delays as well. So it would be like working on writing their letters so that eventually you can get them into a mainstreamed classroom and have them doing those skills.
Were there any specific resources or technologies that you found particularly beneficial for enhancing the learning experience of students with autism?
I guess I'm kind of old school. Like I said, I like to use stuff like the weighted blankets and sensory fidget toys, trampolines for breaks. I would use the smart board sometimes, especially just for like breaks, like certain learning, like videos and stuff. But I tend not to give them computers and iPads as much. I came from, when I moved to North Carolina, a school that was all technology based, but because I was special ed, I had some leeway. So my son had an iPad that he did everything on. So they don't write or anything, but with kids with autism, they really like that stuff. So it's better to kind of use it as a reward, because if they have it all the time and then they need to put it away, there's going to be a behavior issue. So we like to reward with it and put them on a time limit for it. But there are, like, I have one kid in my class that used an iPad device, a tech talk to, we didn't use it much because, like I said, I'm old school. I use PECs and communication boards a lot. So basically the communication board is a paper version of what's on the iPad, but they have to point to it and say the words. And the same thing with the PECs is called picture exchange communication. So they have different pictures. They pick out the book and they put it on a sentence strip and they have to read the sentence to you.
That is so cool.
Yeah, you need like a special training in it. But when I worked at the specialized autism school, I got trained in it. And that's what we used, especially in the pre-K and kindergarten, to get the kids that were nonverbal to start talking. And we used reinforcers. So if they did it, they got like a treat, or like a lot of them are food driven, like they like certain foods, or they got to play the iPad for like 5 minutes or something. So using a lot of timers and visuals are good, so they know, like, this is what you're doing now. When that timer goes off, you're all done with that and we're doing something else. And we have schedule, so like a visual schedule, so they know what's coming next. And like we would take off what was already done, so they know how much is left.
That is so cool. I know a lot of kids who would benefit.
Yeah, from even that. Gen like, kids, yeah.
We had a couple that we could mm-hmm. use it for, even if they weren't ASD technically.
But yes. Even like the sentence structure. Like, to be able to put mm-hmm. the pictures and then you say the sentence out loud, like, it's a whole different way of thinking. Like, yeah. That's amazing. Like,
yeah.
To be able to have that processing,
mm-hmm.
that's really cool.
Well, that's the thing about autism is, like, they just think differently. Like, they're not any less smart or anything. It's just you have to find that little niche that works for each kid.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. There's always going to be something different. Some kids I had to highlight stuff for. You know, some kids you had to stare one-on-one and do one problem at a time. It just really depends on the kid, see what's going to work. Like, one kid worked for marbles, so we should maybe got a marble. Like, whatever they like.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm sure it's hard, though, when it comes down to students who need one-on-one, when there's only one of you and there's X amount of kids in the classroom.
So usually if they're in a self-contained classroom, there's usually at least three people. Most states, the law is 1-3 ratio.
Okay.
Sometimes it can be higher, depending on how severe they are. Like if you have kids in wheelchairs and things like that. If they're in a mainstream into a classroom, if they are kids that will just dart and take off or something, they can get a one-on-one. But it's just very hard. Like the districts don't want to pay for it. So you have to have... I always tell my parents, advocate for your kid, get as much as you can, like, and fight for them, because a lot of districts just try to do what's cheaper.
Yeah.
And it's not always what's best for the kid. Like, I have a former student right now. His mom was a teacher at the school I worked at. She was a first grade teacher. And she was kind of like, yeah, like, gen ed teachers don't really have much training in special ed. And she knew something was off. He had a speech delay and stuff. He came to me when he was 3. So I had him 3 and 4 years old. And she was like, right now he just has like that developmental delay label. And I was like, I'm not a doctor, but I can tell you he's probably on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you should probably see a developmental pediatrician. They're the ones that usually diagnose.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since like realized, oh, this is what's going on, she's really like done a lot, like fought for him to get ABA therapy in the school, which they usually don't let them do.
Yeah.
And now she's like an advocate for the state. And
that's amazing.
When I moved, because he had already been in the ASD program, pre-K program, because he started when he was 3. Usually they don't start that young. They wanted to put him in just like a class that would have like kids with Down syndrome and stuff in it. But he was really smart. And I was like, she was like texting me. I was like, no, he's too smart for that. I'm like, either you fight for them to push him up to gen ed kindergarten or, you know, the ASD kindergarten, or you keep him in the pre-K ASD room. I'm like, tell them no. Like, I was like, you have to fight for him, but, you know, you have to get what's best for your child.
Interesting to see how much you have to fight and what you have to do. So Patrick was a preemie very, very early. We were immediately given a developmental doctor because of how early he was, because mm-hmm. he was considered a micro preemie. And we still on tomorrow, actually, our social worker is coming to do his developmental screening. And we were going to graduate from it last time. And she goes, let's just hold on until we get to school. Because if you have us on board before he's ready to go into preschool, kindergarten, we can get you any resources he may need. It's easier to stay with us than to come back around and get us when you need us.
Yeah, because the process takes 90
yeah.
days. So they have 90 days from the day of initiation. So if it comes down to he might need speech, he could get that in a pre-K setting if he already has that piece with the developmental mm-hmm. doctor. But if you start that not until he gets to kindergarten with nothing before him, they would have to start that when they see something that triggers that, oh, maybe he needs
speech. Yes.
So 90 days before he starts receiving any services, if he qualifies.
Yeah, and it's all through the school district, not private. Whereas, so Patrick has like the early start. His is through Medicaid and early start and stuff like that. And he, when he was younger, he had speech, PT, OT. We got it all because he was technically developmentally delayed. But we're still keeping up with that. But I remember even in the NICU, because I'm like, he's 2 weeks old. Like, you need to fill out this paperwork now, because by the time he's ready for this, then you'll probably get the care that you need, because of how long it takes to do that. And I think he was four months old when we still had our first visit. But that is, I mean, and granted, we don't know what Patrick is yet. You know what I mean?
Sometimes it takes a while.
Like, yeah, we're still learning, but that I will say he's so young.
Yeah, you don't know. He might not need anything eventually, but it's better to have the availability of it than to wait and then you don't know how long it's going to take.
Yeah, and that's what, like, advocating for yourself is so important. Like,
yeah, and you have to, like, really inform parents, because in Florida, they would have a developmental delay until they turn 6. So they could be in the ASD program, pre-K and kindergarten, then turn 6 and get the re-eval and maybe not have that ASD label anymore. So, and like the 90-day thing, sometimes they push it out, like, all the way to the very end. The people that need to do the evaluations, like the psychologist and...
Like the end of the school year type of thing?
So it would still be at the 90 days.
Yeah.
But it would be, because most schools don't have an on-site psychologist, they don't have an on-site speech therapist, they don't have an on-site person to do all these different evaluations, have to pull people from different schools to do them. So it just takes a while for scheduling and then getting all the information back and then scheduling the meetings with parents. So it's a lot, and parents who don't have that knowledge already don't understand, like, if you wait till the end of the school year to bring something up, it is probably going to be the next school year.
Yeah.
Wow.
I can say here in North Carolina, they were very quick, because Sonny has an auditory processing disorder, and they evaluated him for everything, but just kind of try to figure out what was going on. Because in Florida, I feel like he kind of fell through the cracks. He was, like, doing well enough to not get any services, but we have so many kids with, like, their English language learners there that he just kind of fell through the cracks, you know. And here they noticed something right away and, like, took control. Yeah. And he didn't qualify for any of the services in the school, but we knew something was still off. So they suggest I get a private evaluation. I did. And then he got an IEP, like, right away. Like, they were very quick here.
That's awesome. Yeah.
But I also don't know if it's because they know I was a special ed teacher.
Yeah.
and you going and getting an outside diagnosis is something that makes the process a little bit quicker than somebody who doesn't want to do that and wants to just wait for the school to do a overall evaluation there. And in North Carolina, you could be developmentally delayed until 8.
Oh,
and then your category has to change.
Wow.
So they have to have a meeting before the student turns 8, and then they have to pick another category or figure out what the next steps are to either exit them from their IEP.
So that's second grade.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
so your first 3 years is, like, tough for you without getting your IEP or the resources you need.
So they'd have an IEP that's labeled as developmentally delayed. That would be the category. And so they would receive services under that. But in order to continue services after 8, they would either have to have another diagnosis or some type of disability category to continue services after 8.
Now, would a parent have to get that through the school, or they would have to reach out to somebody independently?
It depends on what they're trying to get diagnosed with. So if you think that your child has autism, a school can't diagnose autism.
But in Florida, they do have something where it's like an educational diagnosis and medical diagnosis.
Yeah.
So if, like, we see the signs of the child having autism and they're just not functioning well in the classroom, but the parents have never gotten a medical diagnosis, we can give them an IEP and label them as educational autism. So there was a kid on my caseload. He was in a normal classroom, but he was socially awkward, had some attention-seeking behaviors and stuff like that, and just struggled, like, staying on task and stuff. So he got pull-out services. But when we did his exit IEP when he was going to middle school, is, like, the parents didn't even know because he had the educational diagnosis. And they're like, what? He has autism? They're like, well, on the educational level, yes. Like, probably medical too. But they just never thought anything was abnormal themselves to get the diagnosis.
Yeah, and I don't know in North Carolina if if that's an education. I don't know if mm-hmm. it's an education. I'm not sure.
So yeah.
I don't want to speak to that. But yeah, so that would be how they would go on the next steps. But typically, there is something else that has been mm-hmm. going on. And by 8, there is some other category yeah. that they qualify for. And
okay.
there's also an other health impaired category that encompasses quite a bit.
That yeah, that's what Slim has, yeah. other health impaired. Yeah. And like some of the kids, when I taught the pre-K, they're in the ASD unit, but then it ended up just being maybe like a speech delay or something like that. So the last year I taught in Florida, I taught pre-K ASD, and I was able to push like 7 kids up into the gen ed classroom.
Wow.
So I think that was like my biggest accomplishment as a ESD teacher.
That's amazing.
And a lot of times I think when they're that young, sometimes it's the parents. Like they think there's something wrong, like I said, but there's really not. They're just like babying them and stuff. So one kid, he did have like pica, which is sometimes a symptom of autism. It's where they eat
dirt, yeah, or yeah, ice, or
anything that's harmful
sand,
to you.
Yeah,
it could be anything. Like I had a kid in my class with screws and stuff. Like they'll eat anything. Yeah. So he had like unusual behaviors. Like you know, he was a little speech delayed, but by the second year in the class, he was completely normal with that. And he was just like a picky eater and stuff, and didn't like certain clues, but nothing that affected him educationally. So I was like, no, he's going to gen ed. And the parents were like, what? Are you sure? I'm like, yes. And there was one, you know, the parents were just like, he won't potty train. I was like, just bring him to school in clothes for 5 days. Bring us extra clothes. We'll have him potty trained. And he did. And they're like, but he can't go up to kindergarten in normal class. I'm like, yes, he can. He's potty trained and he's intellectually okay. There's no real behavior issues. Sometimes the teacher has a different perspective than the parent or something.
So what advice would you give to other educators who are interested in working with students with autism or other disabilities from your own teaching experience?
I would say you definitely need to take like some college level classes. Special needs have the hands-on experience, like student teaching. Like you need to be in those classrooms working with those kids with people that are already been in that field for a while and can educate you on what to do. Maybe not just ASD. Like I've worked with kids with cerebral palsy, you know, just ADHD. I've done feeding tubes. So sometimes you got to think about like being a special ed teacher is kind of like being a nurse too. Like I've had kids that are in wheelchairs and blind. So you have to know a lot more information, just like medical stuff too. You have to have that hands-on training to know how to change the feeding tube. You could have a kid with autism that I had a set of twins. They were preemies. So one of them had a trach, one had a feeding tube because they were preemies, but they also had the autism diagnosis. So sometimes kids can have multiple diagnoses. They could have cerebral palsy and autism. Because you have to remember what autism, sometimes people don't really know what diagnosis of autism means. So there's two main determining factors. One is the main one's the communication component. If they have a problem with communicating, communication doesn't necessarily mean speech. So some are verbal, some are nonverbal. You can be nonverbal and still communicate properly. So that's what we're teaching them, the PECs and stuff, because some kids will never learn to speak, or some are just selective mutes. Like I've had kids that never talk, and then one day you take something that's theirs and they want it, and they'll say, that's mine. And you're like, what, that kid talked?
Yeah.
Like I've taught them for 5 years and they never said a word. Every kid with autism is different. And the second determining factor is the repetitive behavior. So that is like the OCD stuff, the rocking, the flapping. Some kids might just pace, some might fingers. Like everyone's different, but if they have one of those things that they do over and over, that's the second key component they use to diagnose it. And it has to be like a neurologist or a developmental pediatrician that diagnoses it. So some kids might have some aspects, it just might be like quirky, but it doesn't mean they have autism. Like it's more of like a pervasive disorder. So when I first started teaching, pervasive disorder did fall under the spectrum. And I used to do in-home therapy with the ABA therapy. And I had some kids that had pervasive disorder, but then they didn't qualify for autism and lost their services. But then I had clients through that had autism and schizophrenia, like, at the same time. I mean, it's just some kids could have multiple things, and some kids might have something that kind of looks like autism, but not necessarily. Sometimes I did have kids with EBD in my classroom, which is emotionally disturbed, because we didn't have a unit that have room for them, and the teachers in our unit are trained to deal with behavior. So I think if you're going to work with kids with special needs, also you need a really good background in behavior. You have to take classes in ABA and just learn about different types of behavior and how to change them. You do need to be trained in restraints, because you are going to have to restrain kids sometimes for everyone's safety. And also CPI, which is it's where you use like the least restrictive way of de-escalating behavior. So most of it's like talking, or like if a kid's coming after you, you're not going to restrain them unless it's the worst case scenario, like you're in danger and they're in danger and everyone else is in danger, then you'll use a restraint. But there's ways, like say they grab you, that if you're a special ed teacher, you know how to get out of the
They taught us that in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So when I was in nursing school, it was a technique, if they grab your hair, how you can take their hand and you could push it to have them ungrab your hair.
Yeah, so if you work with like mental health patients and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's what I had to do before my mental health rotation.
It would be like the same kind of thing. If they grab your shirt, you know how to get out. And we would do, with CPI, you do transfers more. So that means you just kind of move them to a different area. And it's usually two people moving the child. And it's not in a way that's going to hurt them or anything. Usually public schools, that's what they use. But then when I was in the intensive school, we did have padded areas. And I would say we probably did restrain at least one kid every single day. But then there's some people that believe, like, just let the kid destroy the room and get it out. So it just depends, like, what your background is and what your behavior specialist wants you to do and stuff.
It's hard from an outside perspective.
Yes.
As somebody who does not have that education, to be like, well, why would you let that kid destroy this room?
Yeah.
Because, like, in my head, that's encouraging behavior. But I know it's a different way for him to let out the emotion.
And sometimes the kids want to get the hold of stuff because they like how it feels, or they want the attention. One student, they would purposely put himself in timeout to get out of like work, and I'm like, no, you didn't do anything. Come back to your desk. He's like, I'm in timeout. I'm like, no, you're not. And like, some people don't like to call timeout. We have to say like the quiet area or something, but that's what it is. It's like, sit there and think about what you're doing.
What were some ongoing challenges you faced as a teacher specializing in serving students with autism, and how did you navigate them?
Making sure they get the correct services. Just trying to like really work with the whole IEP team. I know like I had one child that was, you know, just academically low, but because before I started at the school, they forgot to do his re-eval when he was in kindergarten. So the school psychologist like was like, no, he's taking the state, like the regular test, not the modified. And I was like, there is no way he can pass this test or anything. So also like collaborating with the parents, because they finally got outside evaluations done and stuff to prove that he could not do it. Also just making sure the kids are accepted. So I would always try to find the teachers that were accepting, and we would do collaborative activities together, like reading buddies. We would have our classes build gingerbread houses together and stuff, so other kids would realize like, oh, these kids are pretty okay, you know. I brought them to specials with the gen ed class, so they did music, art, PE, stuff like that with the gen ed classroom. Sometimes getting supplies, because the school district doesn't always realize some of the stuff we need and don't provide it. So I use the Amazon list and stuff to get some of the weighted blankets are really expensive and stuff. But we had 10 kids in a classroom. Sometimes you need more than one, and they would give us like one. So trying to get the right supplies. Lesson planning is difficult because everything's individualized. You have to make sure. So when I did the street trial, that's like a program you use to teach kids with autism. Each kid has a different program because they're all on different levels. So you would get like a lot of planning time throughout the day to make sure you're making programs that are going to meet the needs to each kid, but also making sure that you're using the same standards that the gen ed is using also. So I'm making sure all those things mesh together.
Yeah,
it's hard. I did work until like 6 almost every night, so teachers won't get the 3.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why like I took a break, because it does wear you out after a while. And like you said, like people from an outside perspective not knowing what's happening or not knowing what you're doing. Like, sometimes they think, oh, you're being a fool, or, like, why are they picking that kid up?
Yeah.
So we always make sure, like, the ASD unit was usually close to the cafeteria. So if they started having an issue in the cafeteria, just go back to the classroom, things like that.
So lastly, what gave you the most fulfillment and satisfaction in your role as a teacher for students with autism?
I would say just making people know that they are, like, extremely brilliant and can, like, do so many things. And just like I said, like, that last year I taught, like, I had all those kids move up to gen ed, and people are like, what? And but my principal was like, if this is the least restrictive environment, she knows it, like, that's good. We don't want all these kids to be in a self-contained classroom. Like, we want, if they're able to be in the regular classroom, we want them to be. So I think just being able to, like, observe that and know that they can move forward and get them to that point where they can move forward and be in a generalized setting is really, like, what the success of a special ed teacher would be.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on today, Jessica. This was awesome. And then before we leave, if you want to leave our listeners, most of the people listening right now are moms, what advice would you give to them as they start navigating school with a child who may need special needs?
Well, I say if you have any doubts at all, like when they're little, get evaluations done right away. Try to get appointments with developmental pediatricians because they take forever. But I would say early intervention is like the best thing you can get because then they may not need services when they're older. Because that's what happened when I taught pre-K. Like, they got the services for 2 years, and then a lot of them were okay when they went up to kindergarten. So the sooner you get help, the better it's going to be. And, you know, don't be afraid to ask the doctor. Or if you, the doctor's saying they're fine, and you still think something's going on, get a second opinion.
Thank you, Jessica. This was awesome. It was so great to talk with you. And all this, everything you've done for all of your students, that's absolutely amazing. They're very lucky to have you as a teacher.